are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, August 14th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, international correspondent for the New York Times, David Kirkpatrick, on his book, Into the Hands of Soldiers, Freedom and Chaos in Egypt and the Middle East. Also on the program today, it's primary day. If you're in Wisconsin or Minnesota or Connecticut or Vermont, go vote. Meanwhile, Peter Strzok, fired, completing the purge of those at the FBI who were involved in the leadership of the Trump investigation, or I should say the investigation into Donald Trump. Meanwhile, the White House, it's revealed, forced its employees to sign unconstitutional non-disclosure forms. The Taliban appears to have taken a major city near Kabul as the who lost Afghanistan question will begin maybe anew, I guess. Seb Gorka apparently has made his own fake Fox News business cards. Not necessarily a news headline, but just too fun to ignore. Israel detains Peter Beinart because he wrote something critical of Israel.
Many things.
And the heartwarming story of a man on a hunger strike to stop a homeless shelter. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Sort of a slow news day as far as these goes. Apparently, the big story is Omarosa has another tape. I guess this is all about her book sales and about revenge. Donald Trump seems to be upset by the whole thing. But there is a news report. We will play at least the news read about the supposed tape that exists where staffers around Donald Trump are discussing a second video tape of him saying the N-word.
Is anybody surprised? Does anybody think it's going to do anything?
I am shocked.
Is it about NFL players? Do we know what the context is for him to
no,
say
my
a word
guess
that
is,
I'm sure he often says?
Based upon the tweet that Trump put out last night, that it has something to do with The Apprentice. Because apparently...
Right. But that rumor goes back years, that there's tapes they're sitting on from Apprentice outtakes and stuff where he
yes.
said all sorts of things.
Yes. Yeah. Well, she's just, I guess, arguing that Trump's own people believe the rumors.
Right.
We will talk more about that later. But he did, Trump did tweet out, Mark Burnett called to say that there are no tapes of The Apprentice where I use such a terrible and disgusting word as attributed by wacky and deranged Omarosa. That doesn't roll off the tongue so well. Wacky
also,
and deranged Omarosa.
I like
his epithets have really fallen off.
I like when he says, like, that level of defensiveness in Trump is a very much.
Is that defensive to say that somebody called and said there's no tape of me saying something that I, of course, never, ever said?
And also, I've never heard him.
He goes
speak
on to say
so negatively about racist language before.
I don't have that word in my vocabulary, and never have. She made it up.
Dude, you're from Queens. Like, even if you were a great guy, that word's in your vocabulary.
Yeah.
You're 70 and you're from Queens.
Right.
Are you kidding me?
But Mark Burnett called and assured him there was no tapes of him saying a word that he knows he's never said.
Donald, I've looked through 800 hours of Apprentice footage and B-roll and nothing. I looked all weekend.
Nothing.
Yeah, Mark Burnett did that.
Just like, can't find that thing that you're convinced you never said.
There was the, like, bragging about rapes and wanting to F your daughter, but actually, shockingly, you never use the N-word.
Like, why isn't he tweeting out about all the other people who are calling him and saying, I don't have a tape of you saying that word either?
I, too. That should be a new hashtag for them.
Right.
I don't have a tape of the president saying the N-word.
Exactly.
Me neither.
BetterHelp, folks. We mentioned this yesterday, is an affordable private online counseling service. You get unlimited access to a licensed, trained, fully accredited therapist that's perfect for you on your phone, on your computer, through text, voice, video chat. Doesn't matter. They're LGBT friendly. It's really good for couples counseling. Anything else you're going through in life right now, check it out. All you need to do is go to betterhelp.com/majority. You fill out a questionnaire. They match you with a counselor who's perfect for you. You start counseling today. If you don't like that person, you don't jive with them, whatever it is, you can get another counselor super easy, super quick, and you're always connected. So you can basically have a session every day if you want. You can connect from anywhere, anytime. A lot of people are not comfortable talking to a therapist in person. Well, I guess not anytime. Maybe during work hours. Mm. A lot of folks aren't comfortable talking to a therapist in person, or they can't get there, or it's too expensive. BetterHelp also has financial aid, incidentally.
That's very cool.
Check it out. BetterHelp solves all these problems. You can sign up right now, save on quality professional therapy by going to betterhelp.com/majority. So Donald Trump yesterday, the president of the United States, was
Mark Burnett assured me that I am the president of the United States.
Mark Burnett called me.
Mark
said,
Burnett
no
said, "I'm not hallucinating."
Tape saying that I have been impeached. Donald Trump went to Fort Drum to sign the Pentagon budget, which I guess is it's quite large. It is $716 billion on the defense authorization bill. Up $60 or $70 billion. Congratulations, folks. We're too bankrupt to pay for anybody's college or healthcare. But when it comes to pouring money into the defense contracting business, we can do that. This will give U.S. service members a 2.6% raise, the first they've seen in 9 years. He is speaking to the Army's 10th Mountain Division, which is the most deployed division in the Army. And here is Donald Trump trying to relate to guys who he clearly feels, you know, somewhat insecure around, because Donald Trump, one of those guys who back when the draft was theoretically impacting everyone, he skedaddled out of it. I think he had like planters warts or something like that. But here is Donald Trump.
Be close. More than $11 billion for the military construction, including family housing, and we are proudly giving our troops the biggest pay increase in a decade. And I know you don't want it because you're very patriotic. You'll say, just save the money. We're going to pay down debt. Does anybody not want it? Please raise your hand. What's going on here? Are these real patriots? I don't know, General. I don't know. It's the biggest increase in a decade. A strong military also requires a strong economy, and our economy.
There you go. The guy just can't land a joke in situations where there aren't people waiting for him to say something racist. I think is part of the problem.
Right.
Apparently, he also. He refused to thank John McCain, who apparently they have named the
name
defense
of the bill.
Authorization after.
That's
like,
correct.
That is.
Well, that's just awesome.
Yeah.
That's the funny part.
It's, I don't even know it's so, all of it is so gross.
It's so alpha.
That I can't even, the idea that you would want a bill named after you that is going to just create, at best case scenario, more misery for people. I, you know, I can understand, like, you want your name on a bill that provides health care for people, or, you know, increases people's, I guess, pay. Maybe that's part of it.
My God, but, you're so gay. John McCain, Jesus Christ. Cedar's a friggin' fag.
There you go.
But right, real quick, can
if
I
he's still around next year, will they call the next one the John McCain Authorization Bill number 2? Or will they call it the Meghan McCain Authorization Bill?
Right.
I mean,
they'll start calling it again after a Democrat is elected, and that will be like one of the Democrats. Like, we're going to start calling defense authorizations after McCain again for bipartisanship.
Mm.
We support Omarosa, right? Because anything that puts stress on Trump's heart is a good thing.
What? Why? I don't know what's involved in supporting Omarosa. Well,
just enjoying and...
I enjoy, yes. Am I enjoying it? Yes. Am I in any way supporting her? No. Would I buy...
Like, not as a person or buying her book, but just sort of generally like, oh, she said something that will upset Trump. Cool, let's play it and laugh at them.
Oh, definitely. Yeah,
and we're enjoying
it. Of course
and
we'll
I
do
enjoy
that.
Looking at how upset he... And he his meltdown about her was one of the ones where you really are and like, you mad. Like, he's really on it. I like that.
When is she coming on TMBS?
I'm working on it.
I think we have some footage of that. We'll play that a little bit later in the program. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to David Kirkpatrick. He is the international correspondent from the New York Times who wrote Into the Hands of the Soldiers, Freedom and Chaos in Egypt and the Middle East, when he was the Egypt bureau chief. We'll be right back.
Be close.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program international correspondent for the New York Times and the former New York Times Cairo bureau chief from 2011 to 2015, David Kirkpatrick, author of Into the Hands of the Soldiers, Freedom and Chaos in Egypt and the Middle East. Welcome to the program, David.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with today is the anniversary, I guess the five-year anniversary of the massacre at in Rabah, where more than 800 protesters were killed in Cairo at Rabah Square. And let's work backwards from there, and then we'll come back around. Just remind us who those folks who were killed in 2013 on August 14th in Cairo and why.
You know, that's a great place to start. So the events leading up to that, there had been an uprising. Mubarak had been forced from power, the former longtime strongman. Egypt had elected its first freely elected president who happened to be an Islamist, Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood. On July 3rd of 2013, Morsi was removed by the military. His supporters, most of them Islamists, held a sit-in in Rabah al-Adawiyah Square to protest the military takeover. And they were gathered under the banner of democracy, saying, "This, you know, our freely elected president has been overturned. We want a restoration of freedom and elections." Their sit-in lasted about 6 weeks before the military and the police rolled in and killed them by the hundreds. Other estimates put the number at about 1,000. Certainly more than 800 have been confirmed by Human Rights Watch. And it's a remarkable thing, if I can go on.
Please.
Because that's a bigger one-day massacre than Tiananmen Square. And it was painful for those of us who were there to watch. It's an amount of bloodshed that is really hard to wrap your mind around when you're in the middle of it. And I've puzzled quite a bit in the time since then about why it's not better remembered in the West. You know, when the anniversary of Tiananmen Square comes around, we publish special sections in the New York Times. On the anniversary of Rabah al-Adawiyah, I don't think many people really even know what it is or what it means. And I have four answers to that I'll give quickly. One is the government did a pretty good job of keeping us journalists out. Some were killed that day. Some journalists who were just trying to cover the events are still in jail because they were arrested that day. The government's propaganda was very effective. Western governments who might have been critical of the killings at Rabah, I think hesitated a little bit in their criticisms because some of them felt maybe somewhat complicit. You know, they hadn't spoken out against the coup, and so it was hard for them to really criticize the crackdown the way they might have criticized the massacre in Tiananmen Square or elsewhere. And the last one is I think that the government's propaganda fell on ready ears because their pitch was these demonstrators, most of whom, almost all of whom were unarmed, their pitch was that these demonstrators were armed and dangerous Islamists. And, you know, we're after 9/11 and after all the history, we're ready to believe that. I think a lot of Americans are already inclined to see Arabs and Islamists as possibly or potentially violent. And so it was easy for them to muddy the waters. But the one-sided nature of the death toll there, the fact that, you know, as many as 1,000 people were killed, really tells a story. This was not an armed insurrection.
Maybe to add a parenthetical fifth reason that maybe you can go backwards in time from that moment to explain would also be that this was not perceived as the democracy movement anymore, which from their perspective, it probably was, right? I mean, there was not, I mean, that's where this gets a little bit cloudy because the coup that took place was in some ways, a failure of the movement to make Egypt more democratic?
Yeah, I would say more than in some ways. A coup is a failure at democracy. But, yeah, the contrast is interesting. You know, in 2011, we saw a sit-in in Tahrir Square that forced the old strongman, Hosni Mubarak, from power. And there were critical moments there when the military had to make a decision. Are we going to help the president by clearing out the square, or are we going to stand with the square and clear out the president? And that's the way they decided. And I think, in retrospect, one of the reasons why the generals decided that way is because of the diversity and breadth of the turnout in the square. That in Tahrir Square in 2011, you had Muslims and cops, you had old and young, rich and poor, young and old. I guess I already said that, but you get the idea.
Right.
Everybody was there together, and it was the unity of that movement that made it impossible to turn against for the military. Whereas over the 30 months that followed, the factions had already turned against each other. So when Morsi's supporters were gathered, yes, they were holding up a banner that said democracy, but they were also holding up a banner that said Sharia. And other parts of the Egyptian population were turned off by that, were also suspicious of the brothers, and had been themselves fighting for power against the brothers. And when the civilians were divided, the military had an opening. It's much easier to demonize one sector or one part of the population than to turn against the population as a whole. And that's what they did. They managed to portray the Islamists as a kind of internal enemy.
Do you think, was it your sense that the military from the beginning, you know, sense that it would go this way? I mean, because in retrospect, it seems that, you know, if you're going to have democratic elections in Egypt following the ouster of Mubarak, that it seems, I don't know, maybe it's just in retrospect, maybe it wasn't, that it would be obvious that the Muslim Brotherhood would have won simply because they were the most sort of like organized singular force in, you know, political force outside of, you know, it seems to me in Egypt. Is that accurate? I mean, could they have foreseen this sort of like trajectory?
Yeah. Yeah, we all did. Everybody thought the Brotherhood would win. You know, it's interesting when we look back, speaking on behalf of the Western journalists who were covering Egypt, everybody thought that the Brotherhood was best organized. They had been the only real opposition party under Mubarak. They had a large grassroots organization, and polls showed that Egyptians liked their ideas, so they were probably going to win. And we thought, well, this could be bad because they may be very conservative. They may try to turn Egypt in a really traditional or even intolerant direction, but at least they're competent. And we were wrong on both counts. When they came to power, they didn't really do anything noticeably Islamist. They didn't turn Egypt in a conservative direction in any discernible way, and they weren't competent either.
Yeah.
But they were welcomed to office by members of the military. You know, now President, then General Abdel Fattah Sisi, told friends and told American officials he was happy to serve under an elected president, even one who had come from the Muslim Brotherhood, that they deserved a chance to rule. After the coup, he began revising his own history and telling American officials, you know, I always warned you, you can never trust the brothers. You should never have let them come to power. But that's revisionism. And at the time, he too was willing to give them a chance.
How sincere was he, do you think? I mean, if do you think he had a sense that this may provide an opening down the road, or do you think he at one point became disillusioned, or at one point just saw the opening and then all of a sudden all these feelings came upon him?
You know, that's a fascinating question. And in my heart, I'm not 100% sure whether, in the terms of Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, he was the Brutus of the story or the Cassius. You know, whether he was the arch conspirator the whole time or whether he was prevailed upon to go along with the coup in the best interest of the country. But when the time came you know, he was looking out at a situation where the military, I mean, the liberals in Egypt were asking him to do something about Morsi. The powerful and wealthy Gulf states were saying, we'll bankroll you if you do something about Morsi. And the Coptic Church was saying, you got to do something about Morsi. And the American government wasn't with a clear voice saying, stay back. You know, he was getting, at best, mixed signals from his American patrons. And under those circumstances, the temptation to step in must have been great.
Let's talk about the signals he was getting from the American government. Like, where was everybody in terms of their perspective on this? I mean, it's you know, you write quite a bit about John Kerry. I mean, it seemed like there was a lot of people sort of freelancing through this process in terms of the American government. Like, everybody sort of had their own perspective and was acting upon it, it seems like.
Yeah, that is kind of the picture that emerges. You know, the way you put it is just right. Where was everybody? You know, there was a situation where 2 days before President Morsi was removed, President Obama was on the phone with him and was trying to counsel Morsi on how to hold on to power. He was saying, look, if you can build some bridges to your civilian opponents, if you can bring them in so it's almost a unity government, you can pull this thing out. And President Obama's advice was evidently sincere. I mean, he even cited the example of Nelson Mandela in South Africa, who Obama had just visited in his sickbed. And he was saying to Morsi, you know, look, you should be like Mandela. You can be like Mandela and usher in a new era for your country. Meanwhile, at the same time, American-made F-16s flown by the Egyptian Air Force were already painting hearts in the sky over downtown Cairo over the anti-Morsi protests. And other voices in the government had already made known, including Secretary Kerry, that they no longer thought Morsi was tenable. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, who'd been handed stern talking points to try to discourage Sisi from taking over, was really conveying the message that the most important thing was a close relationship and that the Americans were going to stick with him. And others inside the government, as soon as the coup happened, were openly applauding. And that includes Michael Morrell, who had been the acting director of the CIA through this period. So you can only say that there were a lot of mixed messages. Oh, and we should mention Mike Flynn, General Mike Flynn, who was the head of defense intelligence at that time. And also I managed to interview him before his short turn in the Trump White House. And he flew over and was meeting with the Egyptian generals in the run-up to the coup. And he has certainly emerged as a very outspoken critic of Morsi and of all political Islamists and a real enthusiast for the coup. And when I asked him very pointedly what his advice to the Egyptian generals was, he was carefully evasive and told me it was too sensitive to discuss. But he also tried to convince me that he'd heard from the generals that the brothers were taking over everything, that they had their hands in the Interior Ministry, that they were on their way to setting up a kind of hardline Islamist regime, all of which is, of course, preposterous. The Interior Ministry was a pillar of the coup and actively moved against Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood.
Did Flynn, I just want to do a side note, did he also try and argue that there was the Muslim Brotherhood had infiltrated the White House?
Yeah. Yeah, he was implying that the Muslim Brotherhood had people in the American government, that Obama was too close to the Brotherhood, that Obama's ambassador in Egypt was. I mean, it was almost like he'd been listening to kind of right wing talk radio.
Almost, or actually handing them the talking points. All right. Well, I don't want to get too sidetracked by this, but this is pretty nuts. Because this guy is now like he's the DIA, right? I mean, it's like he's
at that time he was the DIA. Yeah, I mean, DIA is not such a big deal in the U.S. government. I mean, that's not Secretary of Defense. But you know, when he flies over to Egypt and is meeting with the generals there,
he told me they really greeted
him like a celebrity. And I think if you're in Egypt, then the head of military intelligence is two steps away from the president. I mean, Sisi was the head of military intelligence and got to know Flynn well and vice versa because they were opposite numbers. And a couple of job moves later, Sisi is running Egypt.
Now, I know Sisi came over, I think it was in 2006, and I don't know for how long, probably not that long, but, you know, and took, I don't know, some type of learning annex class at the War College. But when a guy like Flynn goes over there and says, like, you know, I'm with you and you guys should be, you know, I mean, it sounds like was cheerleading, right, for a coup. Do they?
I mean, what he told me was he sat down with the head of Egyptian military intelligence and they were scrawling out on a napkin over lunch their map of all the Islamist threats around the region. So certainly he conveyed a significant and probably acute fear of political Islamists.
Okay, so do they have a sense of like where this guy is in the administration? I mean, I guess maybe this is even just a broader question that I'm curious about. When these various officials come and all express their own varying opinions about this stuff, right? And almost make it seem like it's U.S. It's a statement of U.S. policy in some manner. Or at the very least, it's a statement of the policy of the various departments they come from. How is that interpreted? I mean, how do the military officials in Egypt, how do they interpret that? Like, do they have a sense of how our government works? I mean, I don't even feel like I have a sense of how our government works in that respect. Do they have a savvier understanding, or some do and some don't?
I'll tell you two things. First of all, you know, if you visit Washington, D.C., the Egyptian military actually has its kind of its own embassy. The Egyptian embassy is fairly far out Connecticut Avenue. The Egyptian military has its own defense headquarters right near Georgetown, not too far from the White House. So they have a significant presence of their own and their own independent relationship with Washington. The other thing I'll tell you is during this period, they would actually say to their contacts in the American Defense Department, you know, we're getting a little frustrated here because we're hearing two different messages. You're telling us one thing and the White House is telling us another. And they were openly expressing their frustration at that.
And they ended up going with what the Pentagon was saying.
Well, you know, they went with what they went with their own assessment. You know,
right.
I'm not going to say this is like 1953 in Tehran where the U.S.
Right.
backed a military takeover. All we know is that there were mixed messages, and if you were expecting the American government to really put the brakes on a coup in Egypt, and I think, by the way, President Morsi was expecting that, you were wrong.
And was that a function of, from your perspective, of President Obama's indecision or ambivalence or inability to get everybody on the same page? I mean, presumably, let's just stipulate that the United States, if there was a unified message coming from John Kerry, coming from Barack Obama, coming from the Pentagon, don't do this. We will not back you. We will call it a coup and you will lose funding. And we should talk about that in a moment. Do you think that could have prevented it? And if it did, if we stipulate that's the case, what factor was the failure point? Was it Obama's ambivalence or inability to sort of discipline to get everybody on the same disciplined message?
All right, so we got a couple things there. First of all, I can't just nod along with your stipulation. If Secretary Kerry was here, or if Secretary of Defense Hagel was here, what they would say is, look, the truth is, if we did that, if we took away the funding, if we went against the coup, then the Egyptian military would have gotten money from the UAE and Saudi Arabia. In fact, those countries sent $12 billion the pretty much the night of the coup. So the money was going to be forthcoming. And it wouldn't have made a difference. And I can't say it would have. So whether or not the U.S. could have stopped this is untested, frankly. On your other question, which is about President Obama's leadership you know, sympathetic voices in the White House will say the differences like this are just a part of government, that it's impossible to really get everyone on the same page, that, you know, poor Obama was trying to do the right thing, but he was up against an establishment that had certain prior suppositions and was hard to maneuver or steer, and he did the best he could. Others will say, as you hinted, that the problem is Obama's leadership, that he was too detached, too tentative, and unable to really enforce unity in his government. And I think those are questions that historians will wrestle with, and I hope I've contributed to that in a small way in my book.
In terms of just providing the details to make those assessments rather than sort of making those assessments yourself.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the Arab Spring as one case study, I think you're off to a pretty good start.
Right. Okay. And so moving forward, the reaction to the coup was that it can't be a coup because I guess you've sort of almost provided that answer. The argument in the White House was if we call it a coup by U.S. Law, we cannot continue to fund Egypt. And if we do not continue to fund Egypt, the only implications of that will be that we lose our seat at the table.
Yeah, that's precisely right. So the U.S., just it's worth reiterating, the U.S. gives Egypt $1.3 billion a year in military aid, more than any other country besides Israel. And that's been going on for decades, and it continues. So the morning after the coup on July 4th, 2013, President Obama convenes an emergency meeting in the White House. And he actually opened that meeting by saying, well, obviously we can't call it a coup, because that would mean cutting off the military aid, and the relationship with Egypt is too important. The people around the table had come prepared to debate both sides of that question. And Phil Gordon, who was a White House advisor in Middle East policy, said, you know what, Mr. President, actually, we could call it a coup and cut off the aid, and we wouldn't have to call specifically for the restoration of Mohamed Morsi. We could just say, if you bring back democracy, everything will be fine. And that got his interest. And then they went around the table for a little while. And in that context, General Martin Dempsey, who was the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, surprised people. And you expect the military to kind of stick with its counterparts in Egypt. And he said, you know, aren't we risking our credibility if we don't call what is obviously a coup a coup? But at the end of the day, the overwhelming consensus, you know, led by Kerry and Hagel and backed by, I think, many others in the administration, is that the relationship with Egypt was just too important, that if the U.S. Turned the other way, then the Egyptian military would get the support from the Gulf, you know, that it had support from Israel, that it could get support from Russia or China or whoever else. And so we couldn't stop the coup, but we could lose a relationship. We might as well go along with it.
Okay, and let me ask the other question on the other side. I mean, it's clear that Obama was trying to, like you say, was trying to help Morsi and maybe needed more from Morsi to make that argument internally, and we'll leave it as an open question as to what extent the U.S. could have influenced the Egyptian military. Could Morsi have done things differently? I mean, you know, and like we say, it's not clear whether or not Sisi had this in mind from the get-go, but could Morsi have done things differently that would have made it more possible that those 800 to 1,000, you know, those people in Rabah Square were a more diverse group of people? Like, I mean, was Morsi?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
Okay.
Oh, sure. I mean, we could, you know, if we were to start cataloging Morsi's failures as a leader, we'd be here all day. I mean, he was a lousy speaker. He wasn't an effective politician. He didn't do enough to bring together Egyptians. Now, that said, it wasn't that easy. A lot of the Egyptians were kind of out to get him, and a lot of the state apparatus was out to get him from the beginning. So he had real opponents, but certainly I can imagine he had real challenges. Certainly I can imagine a more deft and agile politician who could have done a better job pulling the country together. And then there's the question of those last days. You know, recently we saw a coup attempt in Turkey. And President Erdogan, whatever you may think about him, he cleverly got out of the way. He got on his airplane and he rallied the opposition from his iPhone. and he managed to turn back the coup. Morsi allowed the military to escort him into a military base ostensibly for his own protection. And, of course, his guards became his jailers. So nobody warned Morsi, and he didn't see it coming.
I mean, he doesn't come off as being a super bright guy.
Well, I think he was a fairly sophisticated professor of material science.
Okay.
You know, his background, he was educated in the U.S. He had a Ph.D. I think he, you know, to call him stupid, I don't think is fair. Did he have experience as a politician requisite with the demands of that job? No.
Right. And was there the possibility of a different leader who could have emerged from the Muslim Brotherhood who, you know, I mean, why Morsi, who doesn't seem to have the skill set that you would want for a politician? I mean, he may be smart, but as a politician, he doesn't seem to have the skill set. Was there no one within that organization who had a better skill set? Like, how did Morsi get to the point where he would be the guy without having what seemingly seems to be so little skills in that regard?
Well, it's interesting you should ask that. So the Brotherhood had two real stars. One of them broke away to start his own more liberal movement. Abou Fatou was his name. And Abdelmonem Abou Fatou. So Abdelmonem Abou Fatou broke with the Brotherhood. He went to the left, and he tried to build a more pluralistic and moderate movement, and the Brotherhood disowned him. And one of the most interesting things I saw was that kind of Islamist-on-Islamist competition. The Brotherhood's other big star was a self-made businessman who had done a lot to really revitalize and organize the machine of the Brotherhood from the inside, Kharad al-Shatir. And he was their first choice for presidential candidate. And he certainly understood power and how to wield it. And the Presidential Election Commission disqualified him on a technicality. A court ruling, politicized court ruling under Mubarak, they said, disqualified him from running for president. And so Morsi was actually the Brotherhood's understudy. So even the Brotherhood did not pick him as their first choice. And he was nicknamed inside the Brotherhood and outside as the spare tire. And that hounded him all the way through his presidency.
That is not... that it does not get, provide a lot of encouragement, I guess, in terms of where he ends up. So how, I mean, when you look at this, well, I should say, how does Sisi compare and contrast Sisi to Mubarak in terms of not in terms of their rule? Because it appears that Sisi is now like, I mean, he initially came in and was supposedly committed to democracy. It sort of feels like that's not the case anymore.
Yeah, that's very much not the case anymore. He'll even say openly, you know, he said in speeches, look, democracy, we're not ready for that. We're a long way from that. It's going to be a while, which is very different than the things he was saying when he first came to power. His rhetoric, you know, 5 years on is all about, you know, look, it's me or chaos. I'm the only thing that's holding it together. My program, my platform, if you will, is just preserving the state, preserving the state, preserving the state. That's all he talks about. It's oddly enough, a lot of the liberals who were the most critical of Mubarak now look back on those last years under Mubarak as a kind of a golden age. Mm. Mubarak had allowed a certain degree of free speech. He had allowed a certain degree of limited political pluralism. And the economy was booming. He had listened to American advice, and he was opening up the market. And they had, you know, by Egyptian standards, fairly robust growth and low unemployment. Under Sisi, Egypt has slidden backwards on all of those measures.
I want to ask you about that, because my understanding in the run-up to the original protest against Mubarak was that there had been a considerable amount
of protracted periods of time with a lot of labor strikes that were disparate around the country, and that they were somehow stitched together by the liberal pro democracy forces, or that those labor unions saw that opportunity, and that part of the dissatisfaction, at least a part of the dissatisfaction with Mubarak, was a function of like Mubarak's son. I'm trying to recall now. Mubarak's son was involved in a lot of sort of like international banking stuff, and that there were sort of policies that were anti-labor that were drumming up things. Was that the case, or am I misremembering, or
No, you got a good memory there. I mean, it's so in terms of labor, the thing to keep in mind is that the authoritarian government in Egypt had never allowed independent labor unions. And there was no real tradition of vigorous independent labor organizing like there was in, say, Tunisia. So what there had been under Mubarak were wildcat strikes. So there was some unrest, but it wasn't the kind of organized movement that we see or are accustomed to here in the West. And you're right about his son. There were a lot of signs that President Mubarak was grooming his son to be his successor, which, by the way, was a trend around the region. A lot of the autocrats who'd ruled for decades were trying to pass power to their sons or people in their family. That includes Assad, who did it successfully, to Bashar al-Assad, his son. Gaddafi was doing it. There were signs that Ben Ali was doing it. So that seemed like a natural enough thing for him to do, and that was something a lot of people were quite concerned with. Let's not forget that the spark was Tunisia. One of the things that really struck me covering the Arab Spring revolutions is just the tenuous nature of political power. You know, you can be the strong man when everybody's afraid of you. And when they're suddenly not afraid of you, you're in real trouble. And so these regimes, when they go fast. And we saw that like a wave of dominoes all across the region.
And so, but there was no, I mean, so maybe to a certain extent, some of the economic policies might have like provided some kindling, I guess, in Egypt at that time. Where is Sisi in that regard? I mean, to put him on a scale of you know, there may have been some moneyed folks who look back on Mubarak as a happy time. What do people perceive in terms of his policies in that sort of sphere?
All the way down. I mean, the Egyptian pound was stronger, unemployment was lower, wage growth was higher. Everybody was doing better under Mubarak. It's not just the rich. You say what you will about liberal economic reforms, things were just better under Mubarak than they are under Sisi. And the economic portrait under Sisi is confusing. I mean, it's worse, right? There was a period when Sisi was getting a lot of money from the Gulf. He was getting support from the Gulf to the tune of $2 billion a month to keep Egypt afloat. And during that time, he sent the IMF packing, right? Morsi had been in protracted negotiations, difficult negotiations about a package of economic changes that would include subsidy cuts, tax increases, trying to liberalize the economy. That's what the Americans were really pushing for. When Sisi took over, he said, hit the road, guys. We don't need to talk about this stuff anymore. I've got all this money from the Gulf. Let's keep going. A couple years on, even the Gulf grew impatient. Sisi had to very precipitously float the pound. The pound dropped by more than half, I think by two-thirds of its value, the Egyptian pound, which means most Egyptians lost most of their savings. And since then, he's really sent mixed signals. He's finally signed a deal with the IMF. It's three times as large as the one that Morsi was considering, meaning the economy is in triple the worst shape, right? The need is much greater. But at the same time as he's begun to make some gestures towards liberalizing the economy, like floating the currency, his government is also talking about renationalizing industries that the Mubarak government had just finished privatizing. You know, they're talking about creating new state-owned steel and cement factories. So, and when, you know, when he's speaking off the cuff, he talks about price controls and state management of the economy. I mean, he's all about major national projects. So he, whereas Mubarak in his last years was at least consistent in his steps to privatize, albeit perhaps in a corrupt way, the Sisi government is kind of back and forth on that and still a much muddier picture.
Interesting. And so let's just turn just I want to just briefly, because I know you're doing a lot of reporting about this in terms of Trump. But where is Trump? Where is the Trump administration relative to Sisi?
They can't get enough of the guy.
Trump thinks
the world of Sisi.
I bet there's something that why is that? Is it just he likes him personally? He likes that style? Or I mean, there's a lot of smoke around the relationship with the Saudis and the Emirates and maybe the Israelis. And you know, it's Mueller's investigating into this. Like, what is your sense in your reporting that you get is the relationship there, and what's that about?
Yeah, it's interesting, in part because, if you'll recall, when Trump was running for president, he was pretty anti-Muslim. I mean, his rhetoric about Muslims in general was fairly caustic. Sisi, the president of Egypt, has often styled himself as a defender of Islam. And yet, when they met, they got along like great old friends. You know, Trump called him a fantastic guy. You are right that Mueller is looking into the possibility that the Saudis and the Emiratis may have improperly tried to help the Trump campaign. That is still an ongoing investigation, and we don't know how that's going to turn out. One thing we can say is that President Trump, President Sisi, and some of those Gulf leaders in Saudi Arabia and the UAE have had a real meeting of the minds about political Islam. I mean, they all share a very hardline view towards political Islamists of any stripe, whether they won elections or not. And I suspect they generally share the view that the people of the region are not ready to govern themselves. And so they've really got along well on that front. And, you know, President Trump has applauded President Sisi for taking control, as he put it, in Egypt, and said that credited him with wiping out a terrorist problem. Of course, there's actually a much greater terrorist problem under Sisi than there was before him, but he has wiped out the Muslim Brotherhood, or tried to.
Forgive me, I'm a little cynical, and I you have much more firsthand experience with this. But is there also maybe like another track in which they could all get along? Because I imagine if I'm a leader of the Emirates or Saudi Arabia, maybe to a certain extent Sisi, one of the other things that I enjoy is the ability to basically get whatever I want in terms of, or not necessarily whatever I want, but that it's not just a job where I'm there for policy purposes. Like, I get a lot of stuff when I'm there, right? Like it's, you know, I'm the lead, you know, it's not like, I get my salary and they give me a place to live for 4 years and that's it. It's no, I have access to the nation's wealth, and the nation's wealth and my wealth are not quite as distinct as they might be in other places, right? Like,
well, certainly if you're talking about the King of Saudi Arabia, that's true. There's no difference between the family and the government whatsoever. I will say this, which you'll probably enjoy. If you talk to liberal Egyptian intellectuals these days, they're not a happy bunch because of the way things have gone in their country, but they look over and they see President Trump, and they see a president who brings his own family into the White House, who tries to fire prosecutors who seem to go after him, who shows a general contempt for the courts and the legislative process. And they think, gosh, this seems very Egyptian.
Well, yeah. I mean, but then there's the other element too, right? Which is, he's also probably enriching himself in some fashion. Like, so I guess what I'm saying is, like, do these guys get together? Is it your sense that they get together and the reason why they bond so well is that they're simpatico in terms of policy? Or are they simpatico because they're all involved in some type of business deal?
Well, you know, that's you talking, not me, in terms of self-enrichment. That hasn't been proven yet, and I'm not going to talk about that. In terms of how they all get along, I only wish I was invited to hang out with them at summits together. But we can be fairly sure that there's a meeting of the minds, as I say, on the subjects of political Islam and of whether the people of the Arab world are ready to govern themselves. I mean, Sisi, the Gulf leaders, and President Trump all seem to be of one mind about the potential for democratic reform in the region, which is it's not going to happen anytime soon. And when it comes to the problem of violent extremism, they all seem to take the view that the answer is brute force. You know, it's not about winning over hearts and minds. It's not about a more open and responsive government. It's not about economic progress. The answer is just brute force. And Islamists of all stripes, whether they want to win elections or they want to fly planes into tall office towers, ought to be treated with the same heavy hand.
All right. Well, then let me just ask you this way, because that's fair enough. I mean, I don't want you obviously you can't speculate about stuff. But is it fair enough to say that, put Trump aside, if you were to put all those, leaders in a room, they would not be averse to making business deals with each other?
You know, once again, I can't possibly take the bait on that one. I mean,
okay.
I have no idea. But it's worth noting that as long as we're talking about President Trump, you know, he's already got some business deals in the UAE. His name is on a couple of golf courses in Dubai. And that, you know, whether or not that changes his thinking or doesn't, who knows? But we can say for sure that it has created a perception in the region. You know, that if you're another player in the region, say the government of Qatar, which has had a spat with the UAE,
right,
and you see Trump siding with the UAE, you have to think, goodness, if he had some golf courses in Doha, would we be better off right now? So just the fact that the government, that the president has these business entanglements creates, if not a real conflict of interest, a kind of appearance problem.
I bet. David Kirkpatrick, the book is Into the Hands of the Soldiers, Freedom and Chaos in Egypt and the Middle East. Thank you so much for your time today. We will put a link to your book at majorityreportradio.com. Thanks again.
Good talking to you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. Those reporters, they always have their all the top reporters all have, like, they really wall off certain areas. They will not go unless they've done reporting on it.
The reporter's code, I believe it's called.
The reporter's ethos.
And then Jamie, I don't know something about that, right?
I know nothing about that. I am not a real journalist. It's fine.
You don't have the reporter's ethos?
You know, they showed me the oath, and I was like, not for me.
They didn't ask you to sign it in blood, was that?
Well, that part would be cool,
yeah.
But I will not pretend to be neutral.
Folks, well, I don't think he wasn't necessarily being neutral. It's just that he won't talk about something that he doesn't have.
Yeah.
He won't speculate.
Those are two different parts of the code.
Right.
I wasn't accusing him.
Oh, there's multiple codes.
Yeah, yeah.
It was weird how he kept dunking on Morsi, though.
What's it?
I'm just kidding.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Just a reminder, this program relies on its members for 96.3% of its revenue. Those numbers are a little bit old. It varies depending on what's going on at any given time. But somewhere around there, between 96.3 and 98% of its revenue comes from folks like you, members who support this program. You can do so by going to jointhemajorityreport.com, jointhemajorityreport.com, and sign up and support this program. And, oh, you know, I had an email. Yesterday we were talking about Chiapas, right? And in the context of just coffee, right? Was it
Alex Jones was selling coffee from Chiapas.
Okay. Alex Jones sells
and we
Chiapas.
Speculated now, as to whether or not he's a Zapatista now.
Yes. Now, I heard from my good friend Mike, over who was formerly at Just Coffee. He's the one who started it all, the relationship with Marin and I. And he said, I just wanted to follow up on the conversation you had Friday, included comments about coffee from Chiapas, Mexico. Not all coffee from Chiapas is Zapatista growers. There's a lot of coffee product produced, coffee produced in Chiapas. Last time I checked, a long time ago, there were two cooperatives in Zap communities that were qualified in the eyes of the government to export. I work for an importer that brings much of the coffee to the United States and wanted to refresh the institutional memory at the Majority Report that Just Coffee Cooperative, which he co-founded, was born from a visit to Zapatistas in the highlands.
Oh, hell yeah.
And Just Coffee currently roasts coffee from the Yaquil Yojabal Cholchan New Dawn grower in I'm sorry. Do you want to? Can you read this?
Oh, yeah. Yaquil Cholchan.
New Dawn, a grower cooperative based in the Aventic region. They also roast coffee from the growers of Maya Vinic Cooperative. Maya Vinic is a subgroup of Las Abiejas, which is a pacifist group in support base of the Zapas in Chiapas.
Nice.
When I was last in Chiapas, there was a grower group whose name escapes me that was just forming to export coffee. I don't know if they're still doing so. So that is my way of saying, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code Majority. Yeah. Get 10% off. You can also buy the Majority blend. Try it out. And folks, today is Tuesday, which means that tonight is Tuesday night, which means that tonight is the Michael Brooks Show, which you can watch live on our YouTube channel or via you can listen to in retrospect on the same in iTunes. Who is on the program tonight, Michael?
So tonight, Trevor Beaulieu, or at Ricky Rawls, he's the host of Champagne Sharks.
Oh, I met him.
Yeah,
I met
good
him.
Guy.
Yeah, he was, nice guy.
He was, yeah, he's going to be in. There's a lot of segments that we're going to get to, obviously, and we have a special substitute super producer in tonight. So I guess stay tuned for to find out who is filling in for Matt this evening.
Yeah,
and then just
Matt heard that the North Dakotans were contemplating there's going to be a referendum.
He's canvassing
legalizing recreational marijuana, and he immediately
and he said, "Sometimes there's a greater purpose than one's own career. I gotta go home." So that's what's going on. And then the new illicit history on Patreon is on Jeremy Corbyn and anti-Semitism, which is very timely. So patreon.com/TMBS. And next Tuesday, there is going to be a secret surprise.
Really?
Year-long anniversary, because we've been doing this for a year, and I want to thank everybody. I want to start teasing this, though. Next Tuesday, surprise celebrity guest in studio.
Wow. Jamie, the Antifada?
Yeah, so our current episode that's up is still our delightful 2-hour-long episode with Matt Crispin in Virgil, Texas of Chapo Trap House, where we talk about Blue Collar and Gung Ho as two movies about the dissolution of the American working class in the 70s and 80s. We also stitched together a bonus because we had so much good content from that recording sesh that we made a bonus for our patrons. And tomorrow, we will be releasing our episode on Posadism featuring Comrade Communicator of the Intergalactic Workers League. So check it out.
All right. And, Brendan.
You guys know the story of
lunch
Flippities?
Of who?
Flippities?
Flippities. No.
Well, look that up, and that's how my week's going to be.
He was the dolphin, right? Who would... okay.
Yeah, his flip... Wow. A Greek dolphin name joke.
Sam does know about Posadism.
There you go.
Check out Literary Hangover and Packable and listen about Hawthorne.
Packable?
Packable and listen to a discussion of Hawthorne.
All right, folks. Head into the fun app, 646-257-3920.